It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We are ready to take over and cover the Democratic National Convention tonight. Big speeches in line, including the big speech we've all been waiting for, Hillary Clinton accepting the nomination for president of the United States and the Democratic Party. In studio with me tonight, Carol Felsenthal, political columnist from Chicago Magazine. Ken Davis. Ken, good to see you again from Chicago Newsroom.
Oh, hi.
And Amara Enya's back. Hi, Amara. How are you? Good to see you. Good to have you here as well. A former mayoral candidate for the city of Chicago and a Democrat who is in Chicago. All right, so let's get right to it. I mean, what do we expect tonight? Why don't we start with you, Carol? What do you expect from Hillary Clinton's speech tonight?
Well, I'm interested to see if she wears a pantsuit. Seriously, given all the attention to fashion, I am interested in that. And I'm interested in the tone of her speech. I think it'll be an optimistic, light-filled.
Positive
speech. And she's, I'm interested to see how she does in comparison to the others who came before her, including her husband, who mentioned that her water broke during his. That was a truly weird speech. And I don't think she's going to be talking about her courtship with Bill.
Right, right.
In fact, you heard it here first. I think she might not let Bill move into the White House.
There you go. Ken, I mean, last night we saw President Obama give a rousing speech. Does she have to keep up with that? Does she have to do something? I mean, all the headlines today have been, can she top last night? I mean, what does she have to do as a candidate to keep the focus on her and not the comparisons to what happened last night?
I just get a headache when I start thinking about the pressure that's on her and her immediate staff, her speech writers, you know, her coaches. Don't yell, but be forceful, thread the needle on things like, the crime bill and trade. It just goes on and on and on. Coal miners, energy, are you going to be for fracking? I just can't even imagine the pressure that's on her.
Amara, what are you looking forward to in this speech?
I'm really looking forward to, again, her tone. I mean, we've had an excellent lineup of speakers the whole week. President Obama, I thought, really brought the House down. He set the perfect tone in both reaching out to Senator Sanders supporters, but also unifying the party. A lot of the other speeches focused a lot on Donald Trump. I think Hillary will have to really strike that balance the issue is of course, her likability and her ability to be authentic and to sound authentic. And so I think it's going to be a challenge for her, but I'm looking forward to see what the overall tone is.
Is the party unified here? I mean, is there any cause for concern that people will be rambunctious when she speaks?
I don't think that there will be a rambunctious response or reception from the crowd. But I also don't assume that the party is completely unified. I think we cannot take for granted that there are strong feelings for Senator Sanders and Clinton and the Democratic Party has to put in the effort to win them over.
You know, the TPP is going to be, the trade agreement will be a big item because the Clintons' closest friend, the guy who was going to fund their mortgage when they moved out of the White House flat broke, as Hillary has said, is Terry McAuliffe, the current governor of Virginia, said, I mean, the guy's a smart guy. I can't understand why he said something so stupid, but publicly said she's going to change her mind on trade, and people are wondering about that. Also, last night, after Obama gave one of the most extraordinary speeches, I think, and then Hillary Clinton walked out all done up and, you know, she looked great.
I'm here.
And you know what it reminded me of? I guess you have to be a certain age, which I am, and that's in 1980 when Jimmy Carter is trying to unify with Ted Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy wanted that nomination.
Talked about this, right?
He lost it. And Jimmy Carter was chasing him around the stage, trying to get him to shake his hand. And I had that same.
They are a couple.
Because Obama needs her to continue his legacy. There is no room between them. But when he was circling around, I thought, what's that? And then all of a sudden, it'll be interesting. Will Bill come up And will he be wearing an apron or something? And that whole
really
issue
caught
about
up
what
on what they're going to wear, right?
Gonna,
but Ken, I mean, we talked about it last night, but I mean, President Obama made no mistake. I mean, he came out and said she's the most qualified, she's the most experienced candidate maybe in American history. I don't know if that's true. I'm fact checked it, but at the same time, you look at her qualifications. Is she going to emphasize that? Is she going to talk about all of the different jobs she's had in leadership form?
I don't know. I was talking to Bruce Dumont today, and he said Dwight Eisenhower reeled up from his grave and said, really, the most qualified? But anyway, I think I just have to say, I know it's kind of trivial, but if there is an outburst of booing and jeering during her speech today, that becomes the headline that will persist for days. Hillary Clinton booed at her big moment. So I don't know. I'm really wondering if any of you guys have any insight. I mean, how do they suppress that? How do they stop that from happening? Do they have people running around with armbands?
Right. I think they exacerbate it if they attempt to suppress it in that way. I mean, I think really the language that she uses in her speech is what can dissuade some of that. If you'll notice in President Obama's remarks, I mean, he directly called out to Bernie Sanders supporters. And he said, we need you. You have to feel the burn.
Best part of the whole
we should be lauding the passion that they've shown. And I think that is how you bring them on board.
Now, I mean, we saw a Donald Trump speech, and this is something that I know from covering conventions in the past. There are always protesters that like to interrupt speeches. I mean, when you hear USA, USA in the middle of a speech, they're not showing it, but there's something happening off stage. Will they treat it that way? Meaning if a Bernie Sanders supporter boos or protests
They'll
or stops the speech,
out.
Will they drown him out and just not show it because, you know, that's just the way that conventions go?
Yeah. Well, and it's the way that this has been a very friendly to Hillary Clinton convention. And, you know, one thing that you said, Justin, that she's the most qualified candidate, Barack Obama said she's more qualified than either I was or Bill Clinton was. And I, you know, the first day of the convention was far and away the most interesting to me because I like chaos and you know, contention.
What were they wearing?
But that was an interesting day, but it has been more and more a love fest every day, building on the next day. So I think I don't expect booing. The right wing is saying that the Bernie Sanders people have been decredentialed and that Hillary people have been put in those seats.
Right.
But you know, I.
But that's a news story then.
But we would know about that story if that were the case and that was something widespread. There are a lot of Bernie Sanders delegates from the state of Illinois that are connected with the media.
And
that
there
were
some. So Nina Turner, who has been a staunch supporter of Senator Sanders, apparently she had lost her credentials or was not allowed to speak at the campaign.
She was not. She's the Ohio state.
Yes, senator.
Yeah,
she wasn't allowed to speak. But I've also heard a couple of things about Sanders supporters not being able to get back into the convention and just some other things that have been going on throughout the course of the week. But perhaps it's not enough to rise to the level of being a major headline.
You know, just to give a little advertisement for my family, I have a daughter who writes for Vogue, and she's there.
She's a great
talk
writer.
About fashion,
yeah.
But she's there covering it, and she told me the first day there were volunteer young people sitting at the stations, and they could be, you could talk them into anything. They were intimidated by people who were older and in the press. And then the next day, she said there were burly men standing there, and she got, you know, they gave her a very hard time. Yeah. So,
I mean, that will always, I mean, that is something that comes out of most conventions when you talk about the stuff that's not being reported. And this seems to be the one story that you hear on both sides of the aisle that is not being reported, how some of the Sanders delegates and supporters have been treated. Ken Davis, Carol Felsenthal. Let me take a break real quick. Ken, Carol Felsenthal, Amar Enya in studio with me tonight. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. We're waiting for Chelsea Clinton to introduce Hillary Clinton tonight at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Carol Felsenthal from Chicago Magazine, Ken Davis from Chicago Newsroom, and Amara Enya, who's an organizer who ran for mayor here in Chicago. We're talking Democratic National Convention, day four, the big night. Hillary Clinton about to speak. Chelsea Clinton, her daughter, is going to introduce her. Ken, why don't we start with that? I mean, what do we expect from Chelsea Clinton? I mean, there was so much made of Ivanka Trump and her speeches.
Her friend.
Yeah. But Chelsea Clinton, I mean, do we expect big things from her sort of coming out party here?
Not to try to out Carol Felsenthal, but will she try to sell her dress online or whatever she wears the way Ivanka did after?
Right, right.
That was one of the most amazing things. Like,
and it was an inexpensive dress. It was like $134, relatively inexpensive compared to couture.
But seriously, though, this is a big deal for Chelsea Clinton. I mean, this is the most spotlight she will ever have in this phase of her life. I mean, maybe someday she'll run against Ivanka for president or something. Who knows? But for right now, this is a really big deal. And she's going to be compared to Ivanka, who got really good, you know, she got good reviews, didn't she? I mean, I don't know.
Oh, she did. Yeah. She gave, I think that Donald Trump Jr. and less so Eric Trump, but certainly Ivanka, who I think that if Donald Trump were to become president, this is going to be a very mixed up first lady, first gentleman election, because I think Ivanka would serve that. Just the body language between Donald Trump and his daughter, they seem very close. It's a little creepy because he made some comments about how if you were his daughter, he'd date her.
Yeah.
But they seem very close, and his wife seems battle scarred. I think she's going to take her a long time to get over that speech, and it's an interesting time.
As well it should. I mean, it was a speech that she plagiarized. It clearly showed her weakness, both as a first lady and just in general, to have done what she did on the international stage. I read an interesting article last week about the dynamics between Ivanka Trump and Melania, and how Ivanka is actually... It was about how fathers, someone like a Donald Trump, they expect their daughters to be tough, to be competent, to be forward and assertive. But in a wife, he wanted, I guess, a more traditional role, someone who's behind the scenes, not who's going to change the diapers that he never changes, that sort of thing. And you see that dynamic playing out where Ivanka is actually the strength in Donald Trump's campaign as far as spokespeople go, whereas Melania is not. I think Chelsea is not under the same level of scrutiny because the competency of Hillary Clinton and her father.
And we grew up. I mean, we all watched her grow up. I mean, this is not something. I mean, for Ivanka Trump, I guess we did. We watched her on The Apprentice. She showed up and sat in the throne behind Donald Trump. But I mean, this is something where Chelsea Clinton, we know a little bit.
And Chelsea's an only child. That's a big advantage. There was this ridiculous moment when Donald Trump had a bunch of people sitting at a dinner table recently, and he said to poor Eric, the middle child, "Who's my favorite child?" and Donald Trump, Eric Trump said Ivanka, and Donald Trump said, "You're right." So how painful is that? You know, Chelsea seems like a very well-adjusted and smart and more degrees than anybody I know.
Okay, so
but nevertheless, there is this kind of weird competition, right?
Yeah,
it's
no,
like
it's so,
all
it's so
the
dumb.
Trump kids got accolades. They were all doing such a great job. And
you
now
see
and
how
now
Chelsea does,
has got to hold up the Clinton banner.
Let's talk about Hillary Clinton. One thing that we talked about last night is do we feel that Hillary Clinton is going to take the tide, the way that it's been going is that for the first part of this primary, she didn't really talk about this sort of being a glass ceiling moment, a moment in which it's historic for women to run for president and be the nominee. Now that she has the nominee, do you expect to hear that coming out of her speech tonight, where she really embraces the idea of history and uses it as a platform to run on here as the election moves forward?
To a certain extent, I think that they are trying to strategically downplay that a bit. And the reason for that is that Hillary is losing the white man vote by, I don't know, 30 points or something crazy like that. And they want to present Hillary as a leader for all of us and not get too much into the feminism, although I think it's going to be there big time because you have a lot of people like Barbara Boxer, who's retiring as senator from California, very close to Hillary. Barbara Mikulski, retiring as senator from Maryland. Mm-hmm. And these women are, they are transported by this. It's a big deal to women of that age.
But it also backfired, I think, earlier on in the campaign. Well, number one is the fact that many millennials and young women actually were not that enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. So that's a factor. Number two is when earlier in the campaign, when she had, was it Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem, and they had made the comments basically forcing women
if you don't vote for Hillary, right.
There's a special place in hell for
exactly, you. Exactly. And that really turned off a lot of women, particularly younger women who aren't as tied to that notion. So I think after that, they started to downplay the historic nature of her being the first.
I just wonder. I wonder because just in my circle and Facebook friends and whatever, it's the first time I've seen emotional attachment to Hillary Clinton. When the roll call happened on Tuesday, I saw so many women post things on social media about history and about the, how they felt and the emotion that they weren't doing during the primary. They weren't doing 2-3 months ago. And it just felt like it was that feel moment that the Democrats are looking for when you think of President Obama or even President Clinton.
I think when they did the first run 8 years ago, Hillary and her people decided, perhaps they focused it, I don't know, they decided that it was all about strength, right? The woman who is strong, who can lead the country. And the significance of the first woman president was really downplayed. I think what they've done is they've done a lot of research on it and they've tested this message and they've discovered that, wow, there really is a reserve of people who think this is really pretty cool. So I think you're going to see much more. I think we have already seen much more, but we'll see more of that.
I'd like to make the editorial decision to not take Katy Perry, who is taking the stage right now.
I know
the all the TVs just like zoomed in on the stage and we're like, is this going to be Chelsea Clinton?
I was gonna say, wow, Chelsea looks really
Katy
different.
Perry, and I'm just going to make the editorial decision for WGN Radio that we're just going to skip that part of it. We will carry Chelsea and Hillary coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Let's quickly turn to Illinois. In the delegation, Rahm Emanuel, Mayor Emanuel, just can't get a break. First, I mean, you reported on this, Carol. I mean, the idea
was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but I mean, at first it was, we don't really want you on stage. Which is surprising. There's other big city mayors from even small city mayors
like Tallahassee.
Right, they got stage space, but Rahm Emanuel was not invited to do that. Then you reported on the idea of he sort of being behind the scenes. He's going to do the buzz party. He's going to be the private party. And then last night, to be the villain or the foil in the video that led up to President Obama talking about affordable care, and the voiceover is, well, you know, Rahm Emanuel said, don't do it.
Right.
You know, don't do it.
I mean, they used his name specifically, and they didn't have to get the point across in the video.
Right.
So they used his name specifically. I mean, he essentially, throughout the entire campaign process, even when Hillary came to Chicago, he has hardly been allowed into the room. And I think this was icing on the cake. But this was really a key moment where you know that there's something going on within the Democratic Party and Rahm Emanuel.
I mean, Bernie Sanders essentially ran against Rahm Emanuel to almost win in Illinois.
Yeah.
But remember, too, also that the other voice that you heard was the voice of none other than David Axelrod, right? David Axelrod talking about how, well, you know, there were people who were saying, oh, don't do this now. It's, don't do the Affordable Care Act. The numbers aren't good. But the president didn't listen to them.
All these pundits.
And Rahm says specifically in that video, you do that, you're going to lose in 2012. Right. And it makes Rahm not even look good at what he's supposed to be best at, which is strategy. And then Rahm is so defensive when asked by reporters from the Tribune and the Sun-Times. And he said, I talked to Bill Clinton on the telephone this weekend. Well, that makes it only worse because, yes, he is close to Bill Clinton. They do talk on the telephone. But Bill Clinton, when he came to Chicago, he didn't have his arm around Rahm.
And Bill Clinton,
he was nowhere to be seen.
So
and
weird.
Bill Clinton at the DNC was sitting next to Tony Preckwinkle. The mayor. So.
I mean, it's just dripping with drama, political drama around Rahm Emanuel. It's unbelievable to me.
You know, we're all media folks, so we all look at this stuff. Think about the process of writing and producing that 2-minute video, right? There were 100 people involved in that. It took 2 weeks to do it, to produce it.
That was a decision made to keep his name in.
And what B-roll did they choose when they were saying, when Axelrod's voice is saying, you know, there are aides who were saying, no, don't do this. And you have B-roll of Rahm Emanuel standing in front of the desk talking to the president. We don't know what he's saying. It's just B-roll. But the implication is that he's standing there saying, don't do this. And the president had to stand up against this and say, no, I'm going to give the people health insurance.
Right thing. Right.
Just, I mean, you guys are covering politics. You're in politics. You understand it. It's inconceivable to me that the man who was behind the, what was it, the 2000, was it four? That he did that he took back the Congress.
2006.
The man who was the chief of staff for President Obama. Mm-hmm. You know,
Rahm gave up his seat in Congress. He was going to be the first Jewish Speaker of the House. Yeah. He was
Congressman,
on his way
was,
to
yeah.
do it.
And I mean, he was on track for Speaker of the House, now to Mayor of Chicago, to be in a position where, I mean, a whole party turns their back on him.
And it's Bloomberg, surprising. Who's not even a Democrat, gets a primetime spot. And he's introduced by the mayor of Atlanta, whose first name I can't remember. His last name is Reed.
Kasim.
He's a really up-and-coming guy. And I remember covering an Ideas Week thing at the History Museum here in Chicago, and the panel was Reed, Bloomberg, and Rahm, and they were all the great. And then
he didn't get it.
So
yeah.
he introduces Bloomberg, and Rahm's throwing a party at a club in Philadelphia.
Right.
Can't find anybody who was there. I'm looking. I am. Yeah.
Good luck.
I know he doesn't get
his fall from grace. I think people are paying attention to what's happening in Chicago, what's been happening over the last several years. He did a lot of damage to the credibility, even to the extent that Clinton could not come here and openly engage with him as part of her campaign. And so I think he has been pushed to a back position in the party.
It blows my mind as a student of Chicago politics to think back to, what was it, 1960, where the only way that Kennedy wins is because Mayor Daley steps up and does that. Yeah. To think of how Chicago politicians, especially the mayor of Chicago, has played a role in national politics, and to have the mayor of Chicago now being swept like, oh, Rob, we don't need you in the room. You need to go.
I just
want to
say real quickly, I think it's a kind of a raw deal. I really do. I think he's being treated worse than he
needs. Is it payback for going for Obama over Clinton in 2008? What is the...
I don't know.
Laquan McDonald.
It's Laquan McDonald. It's the violence that has gone unabated. Yeah. It's the issue with Chicago, with public education in Chicago. It is all of the failures.
All those things.
Also, Rahm, remember who pushed through NAFTA. It was Bill Daley was called the NAFTA czar. Mm-hmm. The guy, the real muscle, the real intelligence and smarts was Rahm Emanuel.
I guess. I mean, it's one thing to be on the wrong side of that, of situations like NAFTA, but it's another to be the fall guy, the pin guy, years later.
Remember what Bernie said before the Illinois primary. He said, if Rahm Emanuel wants to endorse me, I won't accept it. I want endorsements for people who believe in social
justice.
Like
a big pile of nuclear waste.
Yeah. Right.
Carol Pelsenthal, Ken Davis, Amar Anyan Studio. We'll take a break here. We'll come back. We'll do the news. And we're expecting Chelsea Clinton to introduce Hillary Clinton. Coming up. Stay with us.
Okay. Back to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Chelsea Clinton has just taken to the stage.
A proud Democrat. A proud mother. And tonight in particular, a very, very proud daughter. Mark and I can't quite believe it, but our daughter Charlotte is nearly 2 years old. She loves Elmo. She loves blueberries. And above all, she loves FaceTiming with Grandma. My mom can be about to walk on stage for a debate or a speech, and it just doesn't matter. She'll drop everything for a few minutes of blowing kisses and reading Chugga Chugga Choo Choo with her granddaughter. Chugga Chugga got an applause. Our son, Aiden, is 5.5 weeks old, and we are so thankful that he's healthy and thriving, and, well, we're a little biased, but we think he's just about the cutest baby in the world. A view I'm pretty sure my mom shares. And every day that I spend as Charlotte and Aiden's mother, I think about my own mother. My wonderful, thoughtful, hilarious mother. My earliest memory is my mom picking me up after I'd fallen down, giving me a big hug, and reading me Goodnight Moon. From that moment to this one, every single memory I have of my mom is that regardless of what was happening in her life, she was always, always there for me. Every soccer game, every softball game, every piano recital, every dance recital, Sundays spent together at church and the local library, countless Saturdays spent finding shapes in the clouds, making up stories about what we would do if we ever met a Triceratops. In my opinion, the friendliest looking dinosaurs, although my mom would always remind me they were still dinosaurs. As a kid, I was pretty obsessed with dinosaurs. And the day that my parents took me to Dinosaur National Park, I didn't think life could get any better. Whenever my mom was away for work, which thankfully didn't happen very often, she left notes for me to open every day she was gone, all stacked neatly together in a special drawer, with a date on the front of each one so I would know which note to open on which day. When she went to France to learn about their childcare system, I remember one was all about the Eiffel Tower. Another was about the ideas she hoped to bring home to help the kids of Arkansas. I treasured each and every one of those notes. They were another reminder that I was always in her thoughts and in her heart. Growing up, conversations around the dinner table always started with what I learned in school that day. I remember one week talking incessantly about a book that had captured my imagination, A Wrinkle in Time. Only after my parents had listened to me would they then talk about what they were working on, education, healthcare, what was consuming their days and keeping them up at night. I loved that my parents expected me to have opinions and to be able to back them up with facts. I never once doubted that my parents cared about my thoughts and my ideas, and I always, always knew how deeply they loved me. That feeling of being valued and loved, that's what my mom wants for every child. It is the calling of her life. My parents raised me to know how lucky I was, that I never had to worry about food on the table, that I never had to worry about a good school to go to, that I never had to worry about a safe neighborhood to play in. And they taught me to care about what happens in our world and to do whatever I could to change what frustrated me, what felt wrong. They taught me that's the responsibility that comes with being smiled on by fate. And I know my kids are a little young, but I'm already trying to instill those same values in them. There's something else that my mother taught me. Public service is about service. And as her daughter, I've had a special window into how she serves. I've seen her holding the hands of mothers worried about how they'll feed their kids, worried about how they'll get them the health care they need. I've seen my mother promising to do everything she could to help. I've seen her right after those conversations getting straight to work, figuring out what she could do, who she could call, how fast she could get results. She always feels like there isn't a moment to lose, because she knows that for that mother, for that family, there isn't. And I've also seen her at the low points, like the summer of 1994. Several people this week have talked about her fight for universal health care. I saw it up close. It was bruising. It was exhausting. She fought her heart out, and as all of you know, she lost. For me, then 14 years old, it was pretty tough to watch. But my mom, she was amazing. She took a little time to replenish her spirits. Family movie nights definitely helped. Dad, as all of you now know, liked Police Academy. My mom and I loved Pride and Prejudice. And then she just got right back to work, because she believed she could still make a difference for kids. People ask me all the time, how does she do it? How does she keep going amid the sound and the fury of politics? Here's how. It's because she never, ever forgets who she's fighting for. She's worked to make it easier for foster kids to be adopted, for our 9/11 first responders to get the health care they deserve, for women around the world to be safe, to be treated with dignity, and to have more opportunities. Fights like these, they're what keep my mother going. They grab her heart and her conscience, and they never, ever let go. That's who my mom is. She's a listener and a doer. She's a woman driven by compassion, by faith, by a fierce sense of justice, and a heart full of love. So, this November, I'm voting for a woman who is my role model as a mother and as an advocate. A woman who has spent her entire life fighting for families and children. I'm voting for the progressive who will protect our planet from climate change and our communities from gun violence. Who will reform our criminal justice system, and who knows that women's rights are human rights. And who knows that LGBT rights are human rights. Here at home and around the world. I'm voting for a fighter who never, ever gives up, and who believes that we can always do better when we come together and we work together. I hope that my children will someday be as proud of me as I am of my mom. I am so grateful to be her daughter. I'm so grateful that she is Charlotte and Aiden's grandmother. She makes me proud every single day. And And Mom, Grandma would be so, so proud of you tonight. To everyone watching here and at home, I know with all my heart that my mother will make us proud as our next president. This is the story of my mother, Hillary Clinton.
Here is a woman. What does she dream of?
So there you have it, Chelsea Clinton with the introduction of her mother at the DNC in Philadelphia. Guys, now, of course, the video. Your thoughts. Yeah.
Okay, so let's, while the video's on, let's take this opportunity to talk about Chelsea Clinton and preview Hillary Clinton. Carol, what did you think of Chelsea's speech?
Well, I thought she spoke to the nation as if we were kindergartners. I thought the pace of the speech was way too slow. You just wanted to say, come on, get to the point. And I thought really all the takes of Bill sitting there,
there was a lot of cutaways.
He looked like, would Chelsea say something about me? You have a father as well.
Ken, what do you think?
He was scowling and frowning.
I think what we're seeing is someone who is not schooled in public speaking, and she's as good as you could expect someone to be. But, you know, she's had a lot of other outings before this, and they've always been about 2 or 3 minutes long, and they have not been
events. The concept of the speech was to humanize her mother and talk about their relationships together. I mean, did that resonate? I mean, beyond the typical sort of, you know, picking apart the fact that she's not a politician yet. But the idea, I mean, was that the goal was to humanize. Did it resonate?
I think it did humanize her. It humanized her mother. Perhaps a little unfair to expect a rousing speech a la President Obama some of the other speakers over the course of the week. But she did a solid job. The tone, I mean, it is what it is. It was something that was to cast her mother in a more human, more likable fashion before her mother comes on.
You know, the titles of the books and the Triceratops stuff, I thought that was very cute and winning and sweet. But when she started talking about FaceTime, all I could think about was a coup in Turkey when the president of Turkey used FaceTime to stop it. That's what I was thinking about.
Or the, talking about growing up, but recognizing in the background that you grew up in the White House. That's a different kind of
thing. Yeah, there was a little bit of disconnect.
In D.C. Yeah. She wasn't like Carter, who sent Amy to public school. I mean, she's lived a very privileged life, and her husband runs a hedge fund.
So Chelsea's speech, what we're seeing right now in the video is a lot of Hillary sitting in a kitchen she's dressed down. She's talking. They're showing old pictures of her. I mean, is this sort of a beginning of what we should expect from this speech? It's going to be much more in the realm of trying to get people to like her, going after that likability that we mentioned that seems to be her problem?
I think so. I mean, one of the biggest things that has been an obstacle for Hillary Clinton has been the fact that...
Did you know that a dirty CPAP system can make you sick?
Factor. So she's not trusted by so many, and whether rightly or wrongly, she hasn't come across as very likable. So I think they're really playing hard to get people to like her first, and then she can hopefully win them over as supporters.
She has to look trustworthy to those few moderate Republicans that they might be able to peel off.
Is that what they're going for?
Well, I mean, that's one of the 15 things that they're trying to do tonight. They got a very full shopping cart.
I was going to say, I mean, what is, at the end of the day, what is this speech trying to do? Because Democrats, I mean, we've seen the convention's been about unifying the party, getting the Bernie Sanders voters in and making sure that it's a unified party against the Republicans and Donald Trump. What is this speech? Who's this speech reaching?
It's a tough one because she has to veer left to keep the Bernie Sanders people from voting for Jill Stein, the presumptive Green Party candidate for president. At the same time, there are many moderate Republicans and many people in high positions, national security positions, military, who have announced that they're endorsing Hillary. But you saw something interesting yesterday when Mike Bloomberg, who has been a Democrat, a Republican, and now an independent, he was booed because there's a suspicion of Hillary that Mike Bloomberg is her kind of guy, and the Wall Street bankers.
Right. Bloomberg represents the neoliberal policies that we see playing out in New York, we see playing out in Chicago, and Hillary's weakness, especially with the lefter wing of the party, has always been that she's far too centrist, far too close and chummy with Wall Street types, and that's been at the expense of working class
people. That
is
exactly why Bernie Sanders and his following happened,
because
Hillary Clinton has always been known as the from the far left as a Republican in Democrats' clothing.
And it was interesting last night to watch the president. I thought this was not just a phony thing that was thrown into the speech. He sincerely reached out about Bernie Sanders last night, and he hung on it for you know, a minute or so. He kept hammering that point. If they're schooling her well on this speech, they've got her ready for that moment when there's
an
outbreak.
She has to do the same thing.
That she breaks to, not so much breaks away from the speech, but goes to speech B1, where she says how much she embraces this energy and needs this energy to be part of the party. And you have to trust me. I'll have your back too.
Can words do that? I mean, can a speech, if somebody's listening at home who's a Bernie Sanders supporter?
I think it helps. I thought, again, President Obama did an expert job of really tangibly reaching out to Bernie Sanders supporters. She has to win over Sanders supporters before she wins over the general public in this country.
And she has to give a press conference one of these days. Yeah. She has not done any interaction.
Yeah.
Who's her Treasury Secretary going to be? I'd like to ask her
that
question.
Well, we'll get to that. So they're still showing the video. It's wrapping up. That's a long video. A lot of pictures.
Is Rahm in it?
And then there's Rahm. Oh, it goes into attack ad style. No, I have not seen Rahm yet, but they're still continuing the video. Rob is monitoring the feed upstairs, and we'll have that for you when she comes on stage. Yeah, this is a speech. I mean, do we see her doing what Donald Trump did last week, where he painted a picture of what America is, what he believes America is like? Both a very dark place, and also that he's the one to fix it. Regardless of Donald Trump, I mean, that was the tone he went with. He went with a tone that we need to fix America. Does Hillary Clinton go with a America's okay, keep at it, or does she take the same kind of tone that says, you know what, there are some things we need to fix?
I think she's not going to say everything that Barack Obama did was wonderful and we can just skate on his accomplishments. But she's also going to go to that slogan, we don't have to make America great again. America already is great, and it's going to be a much sunnier picture.
Yeah, that stronger together theme, I think they're really going to play that up, both in an attempt to unify, but also to send a more positive message than the doom and gloom that we heard throughout the RNC.
The two speeches, hers and Barack Obama's, have been very carefully knitted together by committees of writers,
right?
To make sure that every paragraph lines up with its sister paragraph in Barack Obama. So they're not going to vary from it very much. But she really does have to be believable in that reach out to the left, which is difficult. She's also trying to reach out to the right. But I'm just focusing on this thing we've been talking about here with Bernie Sanders. It's like that scab might be beginning to heal a little bit, but it's in the very early stages.
Let me ask you, we've kind of critiqued Chelsea Clinton as a public speaker. Hillary Clinton's been doing this for a long time. What do we think of the way that she speaks? And you know, she's not a Barack Obama, but at the same time, does she have an influential or a successful speaking style for these kind of speeches?
I've never been a fan of Hillary Clinton speaking or on the campaign trail. I think that's one of her weakest points, her ability to connect. What resonates with people is authenticity, right? And the sense that they can identify with the speaker and with what's being said. And she has always struggled with that, as coming across as authentic. She comes across as very calculated, very test the weather. And her speaking style, quite frankly, is less than engaging. So, I mean, you can rightly or wrongly judge how fair that is, but it's been a weak point for her the entirety of her 40 years in politics.
I've been really hammering this thing the last few days about mic technique. I know it sounds so trivial, but Barack Obama, some people are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. He was born with a mic in his hand. That's
a
guy who he just understands how to modulate a microphone. You know, we've been in radio for a long time, right? Sometimes you can get right to the microphone and you can talk like this, and it can be so intimate. And then there are other times you just got to yell it out.
Right.
Hillary Clinton has never, in my humble opinion, understood that. She believes that the more loudly she speaks, the more she'll be heard in the room.
And that's what we heard from Donald Trump last week, kind of concept.
Well, Cory Booker. Did anybody watch Cory Booker's? Yeah. It was, if you read it, you listened to the words, it was a great speech, but he screamed the whole thing.
Yeah.
And Hillary has been called out on this, and it's considered to be sexist, but she has an unpleasant voice. Mm-hmm. And when she gets too loud, it becomes more. I think now thinking about Chelsea, she was very careful to talk in sweet tones. And it's going to be fascinating to see. And Bill Clinton, how he managed to tell that story in the most natural, pleasant, twangy kind of voice. And then I heard somebody, a right-wing guy on the radio today, saying that old scoundrel. And that sort of made sense to me, too. But his voice was, I could have listened to him for even longer.
Despite the content of the speech that he gave, which I thought I had some issues with his speech, as much as he's lauded for his prowess as a public speaker, but he does have that conversational tone that's fairly engaging. Michelle Obama, I thought, was expert in her speech, and
beautiful.
She really understands how to galvanize a crowd and connect with people.
It's not the volume at which you speak, it's the music of it really is literally how you modulate your voice up and down and how you end your sentences and
how you ride the crowd. That's amazing. Obama's so good at that.
That idea that you lag 2 or 3 seconds behind the crowd and you know exactly when to move back in. This is something but Hillary Clinton's music is very grating. Her sentences always end with that
right.
No matter what she's saying, she can be saying, "The weather today is really exceptional." And it just doesn't sound.
Remember in 2008.
I'm sorry. I don't mean this to be as critical as I'm saying.
No, it's okay.
I really
it's
don't.
Okay.
I'm not being like bitchy about it. It's just something that she's got to work on.
You're doing much better than Tim Kaine did when he tried to mimic Donald Trump. But remember in New Hampshire, which was her comeback after losing so brutally to Barack Obama in Iowa, and she was sitting in that diner and she started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
That was her best moment in the campaign because it was authentic. And her voice was the voice of a very hurt person.
And that's perhaps what she needs to go back to or rely more
crying?
On trust her. Well, maybe she doesn't have to shed tears, but to trust herself and trust her gut as opposed to doing what's so calculating and trying so hard to do the right things or say the right things.
All right, looks like the video is over and the crowd is celebrating. It seems like Chelsea Clinton back on stage to introduce. She has done it. It looks like Hillary Clinton's come to the stage. I'm not right. I know we're on different feeds. I'm looking at 6 different televisions. Rob Martier's got the feed upstairs. Rob, how close is she? She's out on stage now, but it's going to be like 30 minutes of
let's hope
of
for her
waving,
is,
right?
Yeah,
out on stage right now, giving Chelsea a great big hug.
There she is.
Little peck on the cheek.
White pantsuit.
And for the fashionistas out there, it is a white pantsuit. So we've gotten the fashion portion of the program out of the way.
She's having a tender moment with Chelsea after the speech, and now she has turned to the audience and she's doing the waves and to the arena. She walks out on stage right now. I mean, this is a historic moment. Yeah,
does she do the point? Justin, explain this to me. She's in front of 25,000 people. She couldn't possibly have recognized somebody.
She did. Sure she did.
Who
it's a Democratic National Convention. It's an arena. She's like, there's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Everybody does.
I see Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Look at me point at Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. That's what she just did.
But it's weird. All the politicians do that. They walk out and they make that point like, oh, my God, my old friend.
Well, she should recognize Kareem. He's 7 feet tall, for God's sake.
She probably has lots of friends from Park Ridge.
Something
that is authentic.
Yes,
about
it is.
Her.
Yeah.
All right. So as Rob, as you're monitoring the sound, you know when she's going to come back up. Just interrupt us and let us know when she's going to take the stage and start talking tonight. Obviously, she's moving towards the podium after getting her waves and points out of the way in Philadelphia as the final day of the Democratic National Convention wraps up here with the final speech of the night, the nominee. I get to you. She's been nominated, so you can't say presumptive nominee because she's got to accept it, right? Doesn't she start by saying, I accept the nomination
right.
for
All right,
president.
Justin, here she is. She's stepping right, to the Hillary podium Clinton. Right now. Hillary Clinton getting set to make her historic speech.
Convention that we've had. And Chelsea, thank you. I am so proud to be your mother and so proud of the woman you've become. Thank you for bringing Mark into our family and Charlotte and Aiden into the world. And Bill, that conversation we started in the law library 45 years ago. It is still going strong. You know, that conversation has lasted through good times that filled us with joy and hard times that tested us. And I've even gotten a few words in along the way. On Tuesday night, I was so happy to see that my explainer in chief is still on the job. I'm also grateful to the rest of my family and to the friends of a lifetime. For all of you whose hard work brought us here tonight, and to those of you who joined this campaign this week, thank you. What a remarkable week it's been. We heard the man from hope, Bill Clinton, and the man of hope, Barack Obama. America is stronger because of President Obama's leadership, and I'm better because of his friendship. We heard from our terrific Vice President, the one and only Joe Biden. He spoke from his big heart about our party's commitment to working people, as only he can do. And First Lady Michelle Obama reminded us that our children are watching. And the president we elect is going to be their president too. And for those of you out there who are just getting to know Tim Kaine, you will soon understand why the people of Virginia keep promoting him from city council and mayor to governor and now senator. And he will make our whole country proud as our vice president. And I want to thank
Bernie Sanders. Bernie, your campaign inspired millions of Americans, particularly the young people who threw their hearts and souls into our primary. You put economic and social justice issues front and center where they belong. And to all of your supporters here and around the country, I want you to know, I've heard you. Your cause is our cause. Our country needs your ideas, energy, and passion. That is the only way we can turn our progressive platform into real change for America. We wrote it together. Now let's go out and make it happen together. My friends, we've come to Philadelphia, the birthplace of our nation, because what happened in this city 240 years ago still has something to teach us today. We all know the story, but we usually focus on how it turned out, and not enough on how close that story came to never being written at all. When representatives from 13 unruly colonies met just down the road from here, some wanted to stick with the king, and some wanted to stick it to the king. The revolution hung in the balance. Then somehow they began listening to each other, compromising, finding common purpose. And by the time they left Philadelphia, they had begun to see themselves as one nation. That's what made it possible to stand up to a king. That took courage. They had courage. Our founders embraced the enduring truth that we are stronger together. Now America is once again at a moment of reckoning. Powerful forces are threatening to pull us apart. Bonds of trust and respect are fraying. And just as with our founders, there are no guarantees. It truly is up to us. We have to decide whether we will all work together so we can all rise together. Our country's motto is E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, we are one. Will we stay true to that motto? Well, we heard Donald Trump's answer last week at his convention. He wants to divide us from the rest of the world and from each other. He's betting that the perils of today's world will blind us to its unlimited promise. He's taken the Republican Party a long way, from morning in America to midnight in America. He wants us to fear the future and fear each other. Well, you know, a great Democratic president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came up with the perfect rebuke to Trump, more than 80 years ago during a much more perilous time. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Now, we are clear-eyed about what our country is up against, but we are not afraid. We will rise to the challenge, just as we always have. We will not build a wall. Instead, we will build an economy where everyone who wants a good job can get one. And we'll build a path to citizenship for millions of immigrants who are already contributing to our economy. We will not ban a religion. We will work with all Americans and our allies to fight and defeat terrorism. Yet we know there is a lot to do. Too many people haven't had a pay raise since the crash. There's too much inequality, too little social mobility, too much paralysis in Washington, too many threats at home and abroad. But just look for a minute at the strengths we bring as Americans to meet these challenges. We have the most dynamic and diverse people in the world. We have the most tolerant and generous young people we've ever had. We have the most powerful military, the most innovative entrepreneurs, the most enduring values. Freedom and equality, justice and opportunity. We should be so proud that those words are associated with us. I have to tell you, as your Secretary of State, I went to 112 countries. When people hear those words, they hear America. So, don't let anyone tell you that our country is weak. We're not. Don't let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do. And most of all, don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it. Yes, those were actually Donald Trump's words in Cleveland. And they should set off alarm bells for all of us. Really? I alone can fix it? Isn't he forgetting? Troops on the front lines, police officers and firefighters who run toward danger, doctors and nurses who care for us, teachers who change lives, entrepreneurs who see possibilities in every problem, mothers who lost children to violence and are building a movement to keep other kids safe. He's forgetting every last one of us. Americans don't say, I alone can fix it. We say, we'll fix it together. And remember, our founders fought a revolution and wrote a constitution so America would never be a nation where one person had all the power. 240 years later, we still put our faith in each other. Look at what happened in Dallas after the assassinations of five brave police officers. Police Chief David Brown asked the community to support his force, maybe even join them. And you know how the community responded? Nearly 500 people applied in just 12 days. That's how Americans answer when the call for help goes out. 20 years ago, I wrote a book called It Takes a Village. And a lot of people looked at the title and asked, what the heck do you mean by that? This is what I mean. None of us can raise a family, build a business, heal a community, or lift a country totally alone. America needs every one of us to lend our energy, our talents, our ambition to making our nation better and stronger. I believe that with all my heart. That's why Stronger Together is not just a lesson from our history. It's not just a slogan for our campaign. It's a guiding principle for the country we've always been and the future we're going to build. A country where the economy works for everyone, not just those at the top. Where you can get a good job and send your kids to a good school, no matter what zip code you live in. A country where all our children can dream and those dreams are within reach. Where families are strong, communities are safe, and yes, where love trumps hate. That's the country we're fighting for. That's the future we're working toward. And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States. Sometimes the people at this podium are new to the national stage. As you know, I'm not one of those people. I've been your First Lady, served 8 years as a senator from the great state of New York. Then I represented all of you as Secretary of State. But my job titles only tell you what I've done. They don't tell you why. The truth is, through all these years of public service, the service part has always come easier to me than the public part. I get it that some people just don't know what to make of me. So, let me tell you, the family I'm from, well, no one had their name on big buildings. My family were builders of a different kind. Builders in the way most American families are. They used whatever tools they had, whatever God gave them, and whatever life in America provided, and built better lives and better futures for their kids. My grandfather worked in the same Scranton lace mill for 50 years. Because he believed that if he gave everything he had, his children would have a better life than he did. And he was right. My dad, Hugh, made it to college. He played football at Penn State and enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor. When the war was over, he started his own small business, printing fabric for draperies. I remember watching him stand for hours over silk screens. He wanted to give my brothers and me opportunities he never had, and he did. My mother, Dorothy, was abandoned by her parents as a young girl. She ended up on her own at 14 working as a housemaid. She was saved by the kindness of others. Her first grade teacher saw she had nothing to eat at lunch and brought extra food to share the entire year. The lesson she passed on to me years later stuck with me. No one gets through life alone. We have to look out for each other and lift each other up. And she made sure I learned the words from our Methodist faith. Do all the good you can for all the people you can in all the ways you can as long as ever you can. So I went to work for the Children's Defense Fund, going door to door in New Bedford, Massachusetts, on behalf of children with disabilities who were denied the chance to go to school. I remember meeting a young girl in a wheelchair on the small back porch of her house. She told me how badly she wanted to go to school. It just didn't seem possible in those days. And I couldn't stop thinking of my mother and what she'd gone through as a child. It became clear to me that simply caring is not enough. To drive real progress, you have to change both hearts and laws. You need both understanding and action. So we gathered facts, we built a coalition, and our work helped convince Congress to ensure access to education for all students with disabilities. It's a big idea, isn't it? Every kid with a disability has the right to go to school. But how? How do you make an idea like that real? You do it step by step. Year by year, sometimes even door by door. My heart just swelled when I saw Anastasia Somoza representing millions of young people on this stage. Because we changed our law to make sure she got an education. So it's true. I sweat the details of policy, whether we're talking about the exact level of lead in the drinking water in Flint, Michigan, the number of mental health facilities in Iowa, or the cost of your prescription drugs. Because it's not just a detail if it's your kid, if it's your family. It's a big deal. And it should be a big deal to your president, too. After the 4 days of this convention, you've seen some of the people who've inspired me, people who let me into their lives and became a part of mine, people like Ryan Moore and Lauren Manning, They told their stories Tuesday night. I first met Ryan as a seven-year-old. He was wearing a full-body brace that must have weighed 40 pounds because I leaned over to lift him up. Children like Ryan kept me going when our plan for universal health care failed and kept me working with leaders of both parties to help create the Children's Health Insurance Program that covers 8 million kids in our country. Lauren Manning, who stood here with such grace and power, was gravely injured on 9/11. It was the thought of her and Debbie St. John, who you saw in the movie, and John Dolan and Joe Sweeney and all the victims and survivors that kept me working as hard as I could in the Senate on behalf of 9/11 families and our first responders who got sick from their time at Ground Zero. I was thinking of Lauren, Debbie, and all the others 10 years later in the White House Situation Room when President Obama made the courageous decision that finally brought Osama bin Laden to justice. And in this campaign, I've met many more people who motivate me to keep fighting for change, and with your help, I will carry all of your voices and stories with me to the White House. And you heard some from Republicans and independents who are supporting our campaign. Well, I will be a president for Democrats, Republicans, independence, for the struggling, the striving, the successful, for all those who vote for me and for those who don't, for all Americans together. Tonight, we've reached a milestone in our nation's march toward a more perfect union. The first time that a major party has nominated a woman for president. Standing here as my mother's daughter and my daughter's mother. I'm so happy this day has come. I'm happy for grandmothers and little girls and everyone in between. I'm happy for boys and men, because when any barrier falls in America, it clears the way for everyone. After all, when there are no ceilings, the sky's the limit. So let's keep going. Let's keep going until every one of the 161 million women and girls across America has the opportunity she deserves to have. Even more important than the history we make tonight is the history we will write together in the years ahead. Let's begin with what we're going to do to help working people in our country get ahead and stay ahead. Now, I don't think President Obama and Vice President Biden get the credit they deserve for saving us from the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes. Our economy is so much stronger than when they took office. Nearly 15 million new private sector jobs, 20 million more Americans with health insurance, and an auto industry that just had its best year ever. world. That's real progress, but none of us can be satisfied with the status quo, not by a long shot. We're still facing deep-seated problems that developed long before the recession and have stayed with us through the recovery. I've gone around the country talking to working families, and I've heard from many who feel like the economy sure isn't working for them. Some of you are frustrated, even furious. And you know what? You're right. It's not yet working the way it should. Americans are willing to work and work hard. But right now, an awful lot of people feel there is less and less respect for the work they do, and less respect for them, period. Democrats, we are the party of working people. But we haven't done a good enough job showing we get what you're going through and we're going to do something to help. So tonight I want to tell you how we will empower Americans to live better lives. My primary mission as president will be to create more opportunity and more good jobs with rising wages right here in the United States. From my first day in office to my last, especially in places that for too long have been left out and left behind, from our inner cities to our small towns, from Indian country to coal country, from communities ravaged by addiction to regions hollowed out by plant closures. And here's what I believe. I believe America thrives when the middle class thrives. I believe our economy isn't working the way it should because our democracy isn't working the way it should. That's why we need to appoint Supreme Court justices who will get money out of politics and expand voting rights, not restrict them. And if necessary, we will pass a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. American corporations that have gotten so much from our country should be just as patriotic in return. Many of them are, but too many aren't. It's wrong to take tax breaks with one hand and give out pink slips with the other. And I believe Wall Street can never, ever be allowed to wreck Main Street again. And I believe in science. Climate change is real, and that we can save our planet while creating millions of good-paying clean energy jobs. I believe that when we have millions of hard-working immigrants contributing to our economy, it would be self-defeating and inhumane to try to kick them out. Comprehensive immigration reform will grow our economy and keep families together, and it's the right thing to do. So, whatever party you belong to, or if you belong to no party at all, if you share these beliefs, this is your campaign. If you believe that companies should share profits, not pad executive bonuses, join us. If you believe The minimum wage should be a living wage, and no one working full time should have to raise their children in poverty. Join us. If you believe that every man, woman, and child in America has the right to affordable health care, join us. If you believe that we should say no to unfair trade deals, that we should stand up to China, that we should support our steel workers and auto workers and homegrown manufacturers, then join us. If you believe we should expand Social Security and protect a woman's right to make her own health care decisions, then join us. And yes, if you believe that your working mother, wife, sister, or daughter deserves equal pay, join us. That's how we're going to make sure this economy works for everyone, not just those at the top. Now, you didn't hear any of this, did you, from Donald Trump at his convention? He spoke for 70-odd minutes, and I do mean odd. And he offered zero solutions. But we already know he doesn't believe these things. No wonder he doesn't like talking about his plans. You might have noticed I love talking about mine. In my first 100 days, we will work with both parties to pass the biggest investment in new good-paying jobs since World War II. Jobs in manufacturing, clean energy, technology and innovation, small business and infrastructure. If we invest in infrastructure now, we'll not only create jobs today, but lay the foundation for the jobs of the future. And we will also transform the way we prepare our young people for those jobs. Bernie Sanders and I will work together to make college tuition free for the middle class and debt free for all. We will also liberate millions of people who already have student debt. It's just not right that Donald Trump can ignore his debts and students and families can't refinance their debts. And something we don't say often enough, sure, college is crucial, but a four-year degree should not be the only path to a good job. We will help more people learn a skill or practice a trade and make a good living doing it. We will give small businesses like my dad's a boost, make it easier to get credit. Way too many dreams die in the parking lots of banks. In America, if you can dream it, you should be able to build it. And we will help you balance family and work. And you know what? If fighting for affordable childcare and paid family leave is playing the woman card, then deal me in. Now, here's the other thing. Now, We're not only going to make all of these investments, we're going to pay for every single one of them. And here's how. Wall Street, corporations, and the super rich are going to start paying their fair share of taxes. This is not because we resent success, but when more than 90% of the gains have gone to the top 1%, that's where the money is, and we are going to follow the money. And if companies take tax breaks and then ship jobs overseas, we'll make them pay us back. And we'll put that money to work where it belongs, creating jobs here at home. Now, I imagine that some of you are sitting at home thinking, well, that all sounds pretty good, but how are you going to get it done? How are you going to break through the gridlock in Washington? Well, look at my record. I've worked across the aisle to pass laws and treaties and to launch new programs that help millions of people. And if you give me the chance, that's exactly what I'll do as president. But then I also imagine people are thinking out there, but Trump, he's a businessman. He must know something about the economy. Well, let's take a closer look, shall we? In Atlantic City, 60 miles from here, you will find contractors and small businesses who lost everything because Donald Trump refused to pay his bills. Now, remember what the president said last night. Don't boo, vote. But think of this. People who did the work and needed the money, not because he couldn't pay them, but because he wouldn't pay them. He just stiffed them. And you know that sales pitch he's making to be president? Put your faith in him and you'll win big. That's the same sales pitch he made to all those small businesses. Then Trump walked away and left working people holding the bag. He also talks a big game about putting America first. Well, please explain what part of America first leads him to make Trump ties in China, not Colorado, Trump suits in Mexico, not Michigan, Trump furniture in Turkey, not Ohio, Trump picture frames in India, not Wisconsin. Donald Trump says he wants to make America great again. Well, he could start by actually making things in America again. Now, the choice we face in this election is just as stark when it comes to our national security. Anyone reading the news can see the threats and turbulence we face, from Baghdad to Kabul to Nice and Paris and Brussels, from San Bernardino to Orlando. We're dealing with determined enemies that must be defeated. So it's no wonder that people are anxious and looking for reassurance, looking for steady leadership, wanting a leader who understands we are stronger when we work with our allies around the world and care for our veterans here at home. Keeping our nation safe and honoring the people who do that work will be my highest priority. I'm proud that we put a lid on Iran's nuclear program without firing a single shot. Now we have to enforce it, and we must keep supporting Israel's security. I'm proud that we shaped a global climate agreement. Now we have to hold every country accountable to their commitments, including ourselves. And I'm proud to stand by our allies in NATO against any threat they face, including from Russia. I've laid out my strategy for defeating ISIS. We will strike their sanctuaries from the air and support local forces taking them out on the ground. We will surge our intelligence so we detect and prevent attacks before they happen. We will disrupt their efforts online to reach and radicalize young people in our country. It won't be easy or quick, but make no mistake, we will prevail. Now, Donald Trump says, and this is a quote, "I know more about ISIS than the generals do." No, Donald, you don't. He thinks he knows more than our military because he claimed our armed forces are a disaster. Well, I've had the privilege to work closely with our troops and our veterans for many years, including as a senator on the Armed Services Committee, and I know how wrong he is. Our military is a national treasure. We entrust our commander-in-chief to make the hardest decisions our nation faces. Decisions about war and peace, life and death. A president should respect the men and women who risk their lives to serve our country. Including Captain Khan and the sons of Tim Kaine and Mike Pence, both Marines. So just ask yourself, do you really think Donald Trump has the temperament to be commander-in-chief? Donald Trump can't even handle the rough and tumble of a presidential campaign. He loses his cool at the slightest provocation. When he's gotten a tough question from a reporter, when he's challenged in a debate, when he sees a protester at a rally, imagine, if you dare, imagine him in the Oval Office facing a real crisis. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons. I can't put it any better than Jackie Kennedy did after the Cuban Missile Crisis. She said that what worried President Kennedy during that very dangerous time was that a war might be started, not by big men with self-control and restraint, but by little men, the ones moved by fear and pride. America's strength doesn't come from lashing out. It relies on smarts, judgment, cool resolve, and the precise and strategic application of power. And that's the kind of commander-in-chief I pledge to be. And if we're serious about keeping our country safe, we also can't afford to have a president who's in the pocket of the gun lobby. I'm not here to repeal the Second Amendment. I'm not here to take away your guns. I just don't want you to be shot by someone who shouldn't have a gun in the first place. We will work tirelessly with responsible gun owners to pass common sense reforms and keep guns out of the hands of criminals, terrorists, and all others who would do us harm. You know, for decades, people have said this issue was too hard to solve and the politics too hot to touch. But I ask you, how can we just stand by and do nothing? You heard, you saw family members of people killed by gun violence on this stage. You heard, you saw family members of police officers killed in the line of duty because they were outgunned by criminals. I refuse to believe we can't find common ground here. We have to heal the divides in our country, not just on guns, but on race, immigration, and more. And that starts with listening to each other, trying as best we can to walk in each other's shoes. So let's put ourselves in the shoes of young Black and Latino men and women who face the effects of systemic racism and are made to feel like their lives are disposable. Let's put ourselves in the shoes of police officers kissing their kids and spouses goodbye every day, heading off to do a dangerous and necessary job. We will reform our criminal justice system from end to end and rebuild trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve. And we will defend all our rights, civil rights, human rights, and voting rights, women's rights and workers' rights, LGBT rights, and the rights of people with disabilities. And we will stand up against mean and divisive rhetoric wherever it comes from. You know, for the past year, many people made the mistake of laughing off Donald Trump's comments, excusing him as an entertainer just putting on a show. They thought he couldn't possibly mean all the horrible things he says, like when he called women pigs or said that an American judge couldn't be fair because of his Mexican heritage, or when he mocks and mimics a reporter with a disability or insults prisoners of war like John McCain, a hero and a patriot who deserves our respect. Now, at first, I admit, I couldn't believe he meant it either. It was just too hard to fathom that someone who wants to lead our nation could say those things, could be like that. But here's the sad truth. There is no other Donald Trump. This is it. And in the end, it comes down to what Donald Trump doesn't get. America is great because America is good. So, enough with the bigotry and the bombast. Donald Trump's not offering real change. He's offering empty promises. And what are we offering? A bold agenda to improve the lives of people across our country, to keep you safe, to get you good jobs, to give your kids the opportunities they deserve. The choice is clear, my friends. Every generation of Americans has come together to make our country freer, fairer, and stronger. None of us ever have or can do it alone. I know that at a time when so much seems to be pulling us apart, it can be hard to imagine how we'll ever pull together. But I'm here to tell you tonight, progress is possible. I know, because I've seen it in the lives of people across America who get knocked down and get right back up. And I know it from my own life. More than a few times, I've had to pick myself up and get back in the game. Like so much else in my life, I got this from my mother, too. She never let me back down from any challenge. When I tried to hide from a neighborhood bully, she literally blocked the door. Go back out there, she said. And she was right. You have to stand up to bullies. You have to keep working to make things better, even when the odds are long and the opposition is fierce. We lost our mother a few years ago, but I miss her every day, and I still hear her voice urging me to keep working, keep fighting for right no matter what. That's what we need to do together as a nation. And though we may not live to see the glory, as the song from the musical Hamilton goes, let us gladly join the fight. Let our legacy be about planting seeds in a garden you never get to see. That's why we're here, not just in this hall, but on this earth. The founders showed us that, and so have many others since. They were drawn together by love of country and the selfless passion to build something better for all who follow. That is the story of America. And we begin a new chapter tonight. Yes, the world is watching what we do. Yes, America's destiny is ours to choose. So let's be stronger together, my fellow Americans. Let's look to the future with courage and confidence. Let's build a better tomorrow for our beloved children and our beloved country. And when we do, America will be greater than ever. Thank you, and may God bless you and the United States of America.
So there you have it. History at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Justin.
How about that? So the speech probably, what did we say, about 50 minutes?
Almost an hour.
Almost an hour. So an hour, a little less than what Donald Trump did at the Republican National Convention. Carol Felsenthal, Ken Davis, and Amara Enyan studio with me tonight. Let's get right to it. Why don't we start with you, Amara? What did you think of the speech? What did you think of Hillary Clinton's her speech to America?
Well, I think she hit some strong points. I mean, what stood out to me was a lot of the rhetoric, particularly around the economy. It looked like she borrowed some pages out of Bernie Sanders' book, talking about jobs. She made strong statements even with Citizens United, talking about income, the middle class. So it seemed like she was really trying to cater to the left with a lot of her speech, while some of the other parts of her speech were catering to all America or the entire country. So I thought you borrowed a little bit from the left.
I will say this, right before we got to Hillary Clinton's speech, we talked about her speaking style. I thought she delivered tonight. I thought she had a great speech. I don't think that she suffered from some of the things we talked about on the campaign trail. She was measured. She came out pretty strong, and she delivered a pretty good speech. Ken Davis, what do you think of the speech?
No, I totally agree with that. I was, you know, kind of thinking that it wouldn't go as well as it did. But it definitely it hit all the high points. I mean, there are a number of, you know, just key points in it, like the, you know, the talking about the public part and how she had this private side, too, that she wanted us to know about, reminded us of her faith, that she's a person of faith, the Methodist part of it. Mm-hmm. She likes to sweat the details. There are no ceilings when the sky is the limit. These kinds of very uplifting things. And, of course, as we've been saying all night, she had to differentiate herself from this downer speech that Trump gave, and I think she did. It felt that way to me.
Carol Felsenthal, what did you think of the speech?
I thought it was a good speech, and I think one of the lines beside the one that Ken just mentioned about the sky's the limit was when she used the phrase "Morning in America," which is a Ronald Reagan phrase. I don't know how many people are old enough to really catch that reference. And then talked about Trump is delivering a speech about midnight in America. I thought that was strong. I also thought that the personal stuff was good, although, as I said to Ken, these politicians have a handful of stories. I've heard every one of them. But the one about her mother being abandoned and a school right. teacher bringing her lunch every day, that one always impacts me and affects me. I love watching the audience reaction, and Bernie Sanders looked like he had a bad case of heartburn. He never cracked a smile. I mean, he actually looked rather angry. Bill, I think, has a hard time, Bill Clinton, when the speech isn't about him or he's not delivering it. And at one point, he started to nod off.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you mentioned, Amara, that she seemed to hit the Bernie Sanders points, the talking points that Bernie Sanders ran his campaign on. Bernie Sanders seemed to be not that – yeah, I agree with you, Carol. The cutaways to Bernie Sanders, he didn't seem to be having a great time. There were some protests. That's when you heard the Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. But I don't think that was out of step than what we heard during Trump's speech. We heard a lot of USA, USA, USA. That's the same thing. They're just covering up for protests. But overall, as you said, I mean, it does feel that she has tapped into the talking points that Bernie Sanders sort of pushed forward.
She definitely did. I think one of the things that stood out to me is the fact that there were some contradictions, though. So, for example, she talked about the fact that our democracy is not working, our democracy is not strong. But then you can hearken back to the fact that the emails released this week show that the DNC blatantly favored Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. So if we're talking about integrity of democracy, that's a contradiction. She also talked about the Wall Street. She came out strong against Wall Street, which mm-hmm. is a lot of what
it's kind of surprising,
Sanders'
right?
rhetoric is. But then did mm-hmm. she release the transcripts of the speeches that she gave to Wall Street bankers? That hasn't happened. So some of the rhetoric is that it's a little bit disconnected because it's things that Bernie Sanders ran on and was consistent on, and she hasn't been. So it did seem like you're borrowing from the language when you have the real thing sitting right there mm-hmm. in the audience.
Right. And you know, if she gets on Donald Trump, as she should and we all should, for not releasing his tax returns, he's going to come back and say, how about those trains? When they're not equal.
Right.
But I also thought it was interesting, and I expected it, that she would mention Scranton, Pennsylvania, where her paternal family came from, and you know, Trump was campaigning there. Scranton is a white city. It's full of men without college degrees who are aging, and so that's going to be a very interesting collision point. And also, she said the economy isn't working, and I thought not only democracy but the economy isn't working for a lot of people, and I thought that was a good point. I think if you read the speech, you're going to say there were really a lot of great lines in there, and it was a persuasive speech. Her delivery isn't good.
I didn't have a problem with her delivery tonight. I actually thought that she came through in that regard.
Yeah. The delicateness of having to say these things while these things were happening in the last 8 years with the guy she was embracing so strongly on stage. It's a very, very narrow line to have to walk. And I thought, you know, she did get very specific about the Supreme Court, Citizens United, expanding voting rights, those kinds of things. But you couldn't help but think that for a lot of these things, like more jobs in the United States of America, this is going to happen if and only if she's able to persuade the American people to change the Congress. I mean, I don't think she's going to be able to do this with the current House and the current
Senate.
What
I thought was interesting, and this is something that the Republicans have seized a little bit, but she did come, she brought it back to say that, you know, the Democrats are the working class party or for working people. And that was something where she spent a lot of time on jobs and making sure. She recognized that the Democratic Party has shied away or is kind of fallen away from helping and spent a lot of time and about the three quarters of the way through the speech talking about issues of working class people, which seem to be where Donald Trump is getting a lot of his strength, where people who are feeling that
right.
they're not getting the American dream.
They're on the same page about outsourcing jobs. Donald Trump is saying the same thing. We have to punish these companies financially that do it. Donald Trump, I think, is talking about a 25 or 30% tax. But what's so frustrating to me as a person who's followed politics so long and so closely is that these things are so hard to get done because there's no cooperation between mm-hmm. the executive and the legislative. Mm-hmm. So I think what Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine and the others have to do is they have to really work to bring the Senate back to the Democrats.
That's the only way that anything that she stated in her speech has a hope of getting done. But again, for her to do that, she really has to win over those supporters. I mean, Donald Trump and the commonality between Senator Sanders and Trump is the fact that there are a lot of disaffected people who understand that the country and the systems have not worked for them. And that's why they were so passionate. So unless she can tap into that passion and win them over to believe the rhetoric that she's stating, it's going to be very difficult to do that and for her to help down ballot candidates.
Amar Enya, Ken Davis, Carol Felsenthal, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll hear from some of our colleagues and some of the Illinois delegation in Philadelphia, what they thought of the speech being inside the arena, the Wells Fargo Center. We'll continue our coverage of the Democratic National Convention here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. The Democratic National Convention wrapping up with Hillary Clinton's speech accepting the nomination to be the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party. In studio with me, Carol Felsenthal, Ken Davis, Amar Enya. We're expecting to hear from Ro Khan and Ana de Vellantes, as well as Dave Lundy and others from the Illinois delegation in Philadelphia in the arena. One thing, it's a very small point, but one of our members of the delegation did take center stage for just a second in a cutaway on the television with Mayor Rahm Emanuel when they were mentioning violence in city. It wasn't even like the "we're going to work together" and then you show men. No, it was a setup to the end of
now,
it.
Now, in fairness,
you can't get any support.
That was a decision made in the control room at ABC.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
right.
they had a camera on him and they obviously were watching the script and it's like, oh, and when she says, "and too many people are children are dying in our cities."
Yeah. Yeah.
Then cut away Rahm to Rahm Emanuel.
Somebody, I thought that was just a complete coincidence.
How could we know?
Yeah.
Okay. But she did a good job, you know. I think she did a very good job. And I'm still kind of sitting here thinking about a while back. A woman was walking by on Michigan Avenue, a middle-aged woman with her Hillary for Prison T-shirt on.
Oh no!
And I'm just thinking, is there any way that she can be reached? I mean, will she even know about this speech? Will those folks be in any way moved by the speech tonight?
I'm not sure. There's a lot of all caps text coming in, so I'm just going to leave those be. But there is definitely people who have a problem with the Hillary Clinton speech
tonight.
What do
you think of the Republican National Convention? That was the theme, lock her up.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was frightening. It reminded me like something out of a horror movie. And it was really tacky, but that was the theme. Well, and I saw, I miss the woman with that T-shirt, but I've seen a lot of women walk past this studio gazing in who looked moved. Or they look like something had happened, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, I don't know.
I think something did happen. I mean, she did deliver a solid speech tonight. She attempted to really reach to Sanders supporters and to present a unified message. But one of the things that I think is going to happen is the way that you reach those voters who simply could not get behind Hillary Clinton is not by the fear rhetoric. It's not by, if you don't vote for Hillary, then you're the reason why Trump wins. That is not the way to effectively win them over. So both Hillary and her campaign will have to use the language that ignited Sanders supporters, the language that is resonating with independents. That's the only way I think she brings them on board.
And I will say that the moments in this speech that grabbed that got people out of their seats or grabbed that emotion again was about the historic nature of a woman being mm-hmm. the first nominee for president of the United States. It seems like that is the thing that is resonating with the voters in that room. And it still seems, checking out Twitter and checking out Facebook tonight, it still seems that that is resonating with voters.
Cindy, it was an interesting structure, too, the way she said, she put the "and I accept your nomination" right smack in the middle of the speech,
right,
and then
right.
went back for another thing. I learned something really interesting today that I never knew. Do you know that no presidential election has ever been won by a Democrat? Let me put this a different way. White college educated people have never been a winning category for any presidential thing in the United States. It's really weird. They just never win them. So that's another thing that she's up against here. The demography in some ways is not on her side.
Okay, well, we are covering the Democratic National Convention and the speech. We're going to hear from Ro Khan. We're also going to hear from Dave Lundy coming up. There's a lot of people to talk to tonight here on the download and special coverage. You know, one of the things I thought was so interesting is that at the halfway point, like you said, she kind of made the speech a little bit more like a puzzle. She moved things around that usually are in traditional different places. But the one thing she said, which we haven't talked about, is that she really doesn't like being in the public. And that was something that I think she gets a bad rap. I think a lot of people will say, oh, she loves the spotlight. Maybe she's not being truthful with her words here. But she talked about serving people. She likes it, but she doesn't like the public. And she talked about how, you know, I don't know if I can get people to like me or understand me. But it seemed to be something that I learned about Hillary Clinton, because I never really felt that had been public, the fact that she didn't like being there.
I can actually identify with that. I mean, there's some people who service is more of a calling and they're not necessarily in it for the publicity. And there are others who clearly love the publicity, who love the engagement, Bill Clinton is one of those types. President Obama, they thrive in the spotlight. I never took her for one who didn't like the public. I just took her as someone who was so calculated or just not necessarily the most authentic in public, but not as someone who shies away from the public or who's just more of an introvert. And politics favors extroverts. I mean, that's a fact.
When she was Secretary of State, she liked to promote herself. I really felt that. It was probably in anticipation of running. But when I wrote a book about Bill Clinton's post-presidency, and I interviewed a lot of people, including Vilsack, who was on Hillary's shortlist to
right.
be, and he told me this, you know, he said, you go to the White House and Hillary wasn't there she was there. She's by herself. She's a loner. Whereas they couldn't get rid of Bill Clinton. They'd go to the Lincoln bedroom of he and his wife, and they're from Iowa, you know, they're farmers, I think, in their background. They like to go to sleep early and get up early. They're in the Lincoln bedroom. There's a knock on the door, and it's Bill Clinton coming in, and he sits down on the bed, and he's just a person who needs other people. Hillary doesn't need other people, but she has this great trait of keeping her friends. She kept
All right.
her friends from high school.
Let's go to Philadelphia. We got the people lined up. Let's start with Ro Khan, who is at the in Philadelphia covering for ABC News. He joins us now. Ro, I don't know if you're with Anna or just by yourself. But
no, Anna's with us.
Okay, Anna DeVlantis as well. You guys, tell us a little bit about what you thought of the speech.
Too many balloons, Justin. That's all I can tell you.
we're glad we're up here and not down there.
There are 110,000 balloons were dropped, and it literally trapped the candidate, the vice presidential candidate, Bill Clinton, the entire Clinton family, and some other unfortunate people who were unfortunate to begin with, which is why they ended up on the stage, and they couldn't get off. It was like almost a Spinal Tap moment.
And then the Secret Service looked a little frantic when they couldn't even see who they were protecting. It's sort of like they're sort of moving around and like, where's Bill? Where's Hillary? But everybody
got balloons,
off the
balloons. You gotta go confetti. I'm not a big balloons guy.
But the question was confetti too.
Balloons than the Republicans though? That's the question.
It was like a flashbang grenade went off in here. It was crazy. I don't know. But anyway, so as a speech, I thought that it was a very good speech. It wasn't certainly not the best speech of this convention. That would have to go to Barack Obama. And I think that also Joe Biden may have made a better speech. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton, it was kind of a sweet ode to her. Although tonight, you know, she kind of went there a little bit.
Right.
She
were talking about that, right?
Yeah. She touched on that issue of, you know what? I had to hand out a can of whoop ass at some point. Was sort of her position. That yeah, that's what I took away from it. Those weren't her exact words.
Well, she seemed to have a ribbing, if you will, right at the beginning of the speech of former President Bill Clinton, saying we had good times and we've had hard times, and you know, I got to, what did he call it, the explainer in chief?
Yeah, she, well, that's it, that they called him back then. Yeah, that was just sort of what, yeah, like the right.
Well,
do not
Obama.
Believe your lying eyes. Anyway, so this was a good speech. It was solid. This is an historic moment. I don't know though if it's enough, because you know, she's taking on fear and anger, and those are very tough things. And trying to replace that in a short period of time in a candidacy against, you know, with a love and acceptance kind of, I think in the short term that might be a problem.
Well, I mean, obviously, you guys are in the room. There, we could hear the chants of Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. Obviously, that means that there were protests, sure, and things of that nature. But how did the faithful react to Hillary's speech?
Oh, huge! And the protests in this room were pretty minimal. Just being here, maybe more evident on you know, watching it on television, as they might have, you know, honed in on some of the outbursts. But they seem kind of minor. I can just tell you, being here in this room and being fortunate enough to be here, as an American, as a woman, it felt, there was something really cool about witnessing history, that part of it. It was hard not to be swept away by a little bit of that. I was a little bit surprised she went after Trump in the way she did, but I think that sort of sets up the framework for what's to come, how viciously they're going to go after each other.
Right.
It just seems like the gloves are off and let's go to November. And it's almost a little scary about how, you know, how forceful they are about each other. And, you know, I'd like to, I guess, to hear more about what their specific plans are. And she outlined a few things today that, you know, about how she wants to initiate a jobs bill that's going to be the biggest job maker.
Yeah, since World War II,
and,
right.
And since World War II, and you hope that that can happen. But we've all seen promises like that delivered before, and it doesn't always happen.
Well, for you guys, I mean, you're wrapping up Philadelphia. There's a great picture on Facebook of you guys tearing down. You guys are going to be back in studio tomorrow night. Great week for you guys. Are you going to miss it? Are you going to miss the excitement of these conventions?
No. I want to point out that, no, I mean, this. We actually, the truth is yes, that these are incredible moments in history to be able to have the honor to cover and to witness, right? I mean, it's very special. It's something I will tell my grandkids about. But I want to point out something, Justin, that I've just noticed. One of the symbols of this is the 2016, 2016, and the zero is the Liberty Bell. That's the that is the actual official logo of this convention. And on the side of the stage, on both the left and right side of the stage, there was the 2016 with the Liberty Bell, and someone has stolen both Liberty Bells.
It's inevitable, right?
Someone took it off the stage, and someone's running
Cold
down 7th and Packer right now with a Liberty Bell over their head.
There you go.
You guys hear the balloons being popped?
Yeah,
I mean, this is going to go on for
that's
hours.
Great sound. All right, well, get on the bus, get back, enjoy your final night in Philadelphia. Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantes, you can hear them tomorrow. They'll be back in Chicago. Great work from the convention all week long, guys.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
All right, there we go. Let's now go to Dave Lundy. Dave Lundy standing by. Dave Lundy, the better half of Touche, which you can hear every Monday night here in the Download, in the arena in the Wells Fargo Center. Dave, how was the speech tonight?
Oh, I thought the speech was fantastic. You know, I'm sitting here watching the arena as people are popping the balloons and collecting the signs and the American flags on the ground. And, you know, I think that she did what she needed to do. She, as did Chelsea, you know, Hillary had a mission. She had to reintroduce herself to the American people, so many of whom have notions that were formed about her decades ago. And I think that she did that very effectively. The convention was terrific. There were some great lines in the speech about standing up to bullies. But the part that really stood out to me, you know, was when she tied our being in Philadelphia and talked a little bit about the history of our nation. That people thought that declaring our independence was, many people thought it was a easy or clear or obvious. But her point was that it's not only a challenging thing to do, but it takes the kind of leader
that can bridge gaps and can bridge divides. And that obviously is not Donald Trump. So I thought she really took it to him, but in a respectful way, but in a pretty effective way. Look, this is going to be probably the ugliest campaign in modern American history, sadly. But there's real things at stake. And I think that what you've seen out of Donald Trump in the last couple days on the issue of Russia and asking Russia for help and hacking and releasing Hillary's emails, it really points to the contrast in that, you know, Donald Trump is just not somebody who folks are going to find is a legitimate candidate by the time November rolls around.
But we may find that there are actually more emails released in the next few days, which must be keeping Hillary and some of her people awake at night, because that could certainly happen.
I don't think it's keeping anybody awake at night for one simple reason. The people who are going to be upset about Hillary's emails are already upset about Hillary's emails. I think it's baked into the negatives. It's baked into the numbers at this point. But people just don't know all they need to know about Donald Trump. And I think that the campaign is going to be to define him and to talk about some of the things they talked about tonight, some of the things that they've talked about of late. You know, those of us who live in a bubble, and I consider myself chief bubble master, you know, because I'm in this this political junkie bubble. We hear this stuff and we breathe it in and drink it in every day, constantly. But the average voter out there, those that take us from the 30 million or so or 40 million that voted in the primaries to the 150 million that will vote in the general election, those folks still are just starting to pay attention.
Well, so they have opposite problems, don't you think, in that many people think they know too much about Hillary Clinton, and then people don't know enough about Donald Trump. Right. And some people like to take that chance. There's something exciting about the unknown, and nobody would call Hillary exciting.
No, and I don't think anybody who watched the speech tonight would call her exciting either. I mean, it was a great, workmanlike, totally solid speech, but there wasn't a lot of there weren't a lot of moments where you felt goosebumps, other than just her physical presence as the first woman candidate. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you, but that's where the opportunity for the campaign comes in, which is to define him in different ways, and whether it's the Russia thing, whether it's the Trump University and the other scams. I mean, frankly, one of my favorite speeches of this entire convention is not necessarily the ones everybody's talking about, but Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg took it to Donald Trump in a way that nobody else could, because here's somebody who actually was a self-made billionaire. And he said, that is not how you do things. And he just took a chapter and verse again and again and pummeled him. And I think you're going to see that. I think you're going to see the parents of the Marine, the Muslim Marine who was killed defending his troops. I think you're going to see them again. I think there's a lot that was introduced tonight and over the last four nights that are going to really shape what the Clinton message is over the course of the next week.
Dave Lundy is the better half of Touche, which you can hear Monday night. I'm looking forward to that. Get back to Chicago safe, Dave, and we will talk more with you and your colleague Chris Roebling on Monday night. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you. Looking forward to it, Justin.
All right. He'll have fun tonight. Let's last words as we wrap up here coverage of Hillary Clinton's speech, Democratic National Convention. Carol.
I think workmanlike is the way to describe it. I don't think anybody's going to be flying through the air thinking about this speech. But it was more Hillary Clinton. It was like Hillary Clinton.
Ken.
Better than expected. Very well executed. Very well written. And it will serve her well.
Amara.
I think she did well tonight, but it is going to be an interesting next 3 or 4 months.
There we go. All right. So have to say that's going to wrap up our coverage tonight. The Democratic National Convention coverage, obviously a big night for Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. We'll have much, much more, obviously, here on The Download, of course, throughout the campaign. Carol Felsenthal, Ken Davis, Amara Enya, thanks so much for spending your evening with us tonight. You're listening to 720 WGN. Stay with us.